From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, we have an interview with debut author Alka Joshi, whose novel The Henna Artist is on the New York Times bestseller list and was chosen by Reese Witherspoon as a Hello Sunshine Book Club selection. Alka Joshi was born in the desert state of Rajasthan in India. In 1967, her family immigrated to America. She earned a BA from Stanford University and an MFA from California College of Arts in San Francisco. Prior to writing The Henna Artist, Alka ran an advertising and marketing agency for 30 years. She has spent time in France and Italy and currently lives with her husband on the Northern California coast. The Henna Artist concerns Lakshmi, a woman who escapes an abusive marriage at the age of 17 and makes her way alone to the vibrant 1950s pink city of Jaipur. There she becomes the most highly requested henna artist and confidant to the wealthy women of the upper class. But trusted with the secrets of the wealthy, she can never reveal her own. Known for her original designs and sage advice, Lakshmi must tread carefully to avoid the jealous gossips who could ruin her reputation and her livelihood. As she pursues her dream of an independent life, she is startled one day when she is confronted by her husband, who has tracked her down these many years later, with a high-spirited young girl in tow, a sister Lakshmi never knew she had. Suddenly, the caution that she has carefully cultivated as protection is threatened. Still, she perseveres, applying her talents and lifting up those that surround her, as she does. When I spoke with Alka Joshi, we began by talking about her experience of launching this book during the pandemic.
Before the pandemic, I was scheduled to go on book tours and attend conferences and also have my launch. And I had carefully planned out my launch. I'm having sitar music and I'm going to have samosas and chai and, you know, a dancer, an Indian classical dancer. Well, all of that got canceled. And I just went down and down and down, you know, into this space where I'm just like in a black hole. I'm like, oh my gosh, it took me 10 years to write this novel.
Right.
And now I can't even talk to anybody about it. Oh my God. Well, then, you know, we get the call saying that Reese has picked it up for her book
club. Yes, quite amazing.
And yes, and then we had to keep that secret for 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And so what happens during that time is, you know, she has to be the first one to announce it on May 1st. So I am forbidden to tell anybody except for my husband. And he is good at keeping secrets. So, you know, that was no problem at all. But it was so funny because for 6 weeks, what I was doing was helping her book group. You know, they have to prepare content for an entire month while they promote an author. So I was so busy doing little videos and writing essays and putting together photo collages of things about my mother for them. And I would meet people on the street, you know, wearing my mask and walking around. And they would say, oh, we're so sorry that everything got canceled. And I would go, yeah, you know, it is a tragedy. And I'm just dying to tell them.
And you're smiling. You're like smiling behind your mask.
That's right. I'm like, by the way, I am busier than ever. I don't have a book tour to go to, but I am really busy preparing for what's happening on May 1st. So that was a real, real treat.
That's exciting.
What a woman.
Yeah.
You know, to provide a platform for female writers to be recognized.
Yeah.
She's an amazing person.
Yeah. And now you're on the New York Times bestseller list, I hear.
Yes. So that's another huge thing.
Yeah.
Just the other day, my editor called and she goes, Alka, you're a New York Times bestseller now. And I go, really? Are you serious? Like, you know, every time she calls me with some piece of news, I always think, is this a prank call? You know,
right.
Is this really happening?
That's wonderful. Now, you mentioned your mother, and you have said that The Henna Artist is inspired by the life that you imagined your mother might have lived if her situation had been different. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about her.
Yes. So at the age of 18, my mother was pulled out of college by her father and arranged in a marriage to my father.
Okay.
She had been studying psychology And she told me much later in life, she would love to have kept studying psychology. She would love to have had a career. She would love to have had a different kind of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the age of 22, she'd already had three children. She was told by my father, hey, you know, we're going to be going to America, pack our bags. And so she never had the choices in her life that she always made sure I would have. She didn't get to decide whom to marry, when to marry, whether to have children, how many children to have, whether to have a career. Everything was told to her by her family. Right. And so when she was raising me, we come to America. And I think even before we came to America, she'd already decided how she was going to raise me. But we come to America. It's 1967. Guess what was happening in 1967? Sexual revolution is in full swing in America. The Vietnam War is raging. So there are student protests all around the country. My mother's eyes are as big as saucers. She's like, wow, this country is so different from India. What is going on? And I think she just absorbed everything. And she thought, oh, women here get to have a voice. Yeah. Women can speak their mind. Women can do what they want to do. I'm going to raise my daughter like that too. And she, I think, started herself on a campaign to make sure that her daughter could be front and center, not be beholden to a man to tell her what to do, and you know, be able to determine her own destiny. So that is the future that she set me on. And I'm so grateful to that. I'm so grateful to have a mother who did something like that, even though she was from a different generation, a different cultural upbringing. She made sure that I could be very different from her. So yeah. I wanted to give the gift back to her. I can't reinvent her life, but I can do it through fiction, right? So that's how I created this character called Lakshmi, who escapes her marriage before children are born and reinvents herself as a henna artist in a whole different city and is trying to establish her emotional, financial, and cultural independence.
Yeah. Before we get even farther into the conversation about the book, I wonder if you can explain for listeners who may not really know that much about henna, what it actually is, something of maybe the importance of it culturally.
Henna is a 5,000-year-old art, and it is abundant. The plant grows abundantly in Rajasthan. It grows in hot, dry climates all over in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in southern China, and so on. So the henna plant has a property that actually cools the skin. For many years, it's been used on your skin and on your hair. It cools down your body.
Okay.
And so this is why it's used in a lot of those hot areas. And then for a bride to be able to decorate her body with henna means that she can be more relaxed on that first night with her husband. Many times a husband that she may only have met once or twice in her life. And then I chose henna as the profession for my mother, or actually for my fictional character in the book, Lakshmi. Because my mother was very artistic, and I think she could have had a career as an artist. She could take almost anything that you gave her, sticks, stones, whatever, and she could turn it into a work of art that was just very natural to her. So I thought her fictional character, Lakshmi, could probably do the same thing with a henna reed and henna paste, and she could create something magical.
Wonderful.
In my mother's time, henna was only practiced very crudely. So when my mother got married, she told me she just had circles and little dots painted all over her hands. And then the tips of her fingers were all painted in henna. So it was a very crude design. But I thought, what if my mother could have been the kind of henna artist who helped women realize their desires, who helped women realize what they wanted from their lives? And so I just imagined these designs that my mother could have created on people. And this is what Lakshmi is able to do with her clients. This is why she is a celebrated henna artist, able to make an excellent living doing this thing that really women in the 50s in India as henna artists were not actually able to do.
Okay. I wonder, Alka, do you mind if I read a little something from the book and then we talk a little bit more about Lakshmi?
Please.
Okay, great. So this is in a moment in the book when someone that she doesn't really want to have track her down has tracked her down. I'm not going to go into details because I don't do any spoilers, but the landlady at her house has just told her that somebody was looking for her, and she's figured out that it's this person she doesn't want to have find her. My heart thumped against my ribs as I reached for her hand, as much to calm myself as to placate her. Cooking can make the hands so dry, don't you think? If you'd like, I can rub some geranium oil on them tomorrow. A crease formed between her brows, and she looked down at her hands as if she had never seen them before. I wouldn't want to trouble you. It's no bother. And the next time your husband reaches for you, he will remember you as his young bride. I laughed airily, turning to go. Keeping my tone light, I said, I don't suppose this visitor said when he would be back. Mrs. Iyengar was busy cleaning sticky batter from under her fingernails. He didn't say, she said. So I'm going to just stop there. But I loved the way that Lakshmi is, I love the way she is with the women that she works for and with, and the women she encounters. She doesn't work for her landlady, but that little interaction is so lovely. She's sort of kindly manipulative and very cautiously generous. And I wondered if we could talk some more about your developing her character beyond the inspiration of your mother.
I love the description that you just said. Kind, what did you say? Kindly manipulative.
Yeah.
Yes. And so Lakshmi is a very vulnerable position. She is a woman without a husband. People assume that her husband abandoned her, and so they don't bring it up because that wouldn't be polite. But she is alone. She has to be very careful about how she moves in this society where women are expected to be with a man, have children, not even have a career, and yet she defies all of those rules. So she has to be very gentle in the way that she deals with all the people around her in her circle. She has to not ruffle any feathers. She has to be very protective of her own privacy. She doesn't want it to be known that she actually left a marriage 13 years ago, that she actually is the person who, abandoned this whole lifestyle that they would have approved of. So in dealing with the Mrs. Iyengars of the world, Lakshmi has to be very careful. She has to be gently manipulative, and she has to thwart any attempts on their part to intrude into her privacy.
Right. Yes. The other thing about that passage that I just read, which I think is just very exemplary in your writing, is the detail of Mrs. Iyengar cleaning her fingernails, the sticky batter. You know, I mean, I just think those details are so important, and you have such wonderful details. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, the way unique images and details? Yeah.
Yes, I remember my mother doing the very same thing, cleaning all of that batter from under the fingernails. I remember my mother making chapatis. I remember my mother filling samosa pastry with potatoes and peas, which is another thing I put in the book The Sharma cook is doing when Lakshmi goes to visit their kitchens. So I was able to put a lot of things that I remember from my childhood, from my mother, from my father in this book. And that's what was so lovely about writing this book. I wasn't just making up a world that was entirely fictional. I could actually mine my upbringing and put it, infuse it into this book,
right,
and make it real, because it was real to me. I am seeing these scenes in my head as I'm writing them. They are so clear in my mind. Shall I give you another example of what I put in the book that's
Please.
Real?
Yeah.
All right. One of the ways that Lakshmi figures out that Radha is her sister is that she repeats a rhyme, a nursery rhyme.
Yes, yes, yes.
That she said her father sang to all of the girls. And of course, as we know, the other girls were, they died very early in their childhood.
and the only people to survive were Lakshmi and Radha.
Right.
And my father used to sing me that nursery rhyme. Oh. In fact, when I see him, even today, my dad is 87 years old and he is, you know, spry as anything. And when, even when I see him today, he will sing that rhyme to me. So in the book, it's Rando Rani Bari Sayani Piti Tanda Tanda Pani Lekin Kirti He Manmani. And the way that my father sings it to me is, you know, he says, Alka Ran Bari Sayani, and then so on. So, yeah, he just made that one day. He just, when I was a kid, he just started singing it, and he has sung it to me my entire life.
Oh, he made it up.
Yeah, he made it up. It doesn't even make any sense.
Oh, funny. Oh, that's wonderful that you got to use it. He must love that.
Yeah. Oh, you know, my parents just loved this novel. My parents were really into it. And they were also born before independence, and they lived through independence, and they lived after independence. And right. We moved from India in 1967. So I was able to mine a lot of their recollections and their memories of what India was like. My father was one of those engineers who answered the call of the Indian government saying, young men, learn about engineering, learn about architecture, help us build an infrastructure for India that we can call our own. We are finally out of the clutches of the British, and we get to rebuild this country. My father was one of those people,
wow.
You know, and he was involved in the state of Rajasthan. He built roads and dams and bridges. And he was one of those, I think, the early people in India who really helped rebuild this nation into the strong nation that I think it is today.
That's cool. Speaking of your parents, and that reminds me of Lakshmi, is very close to her, or really hopeful that she will be able to be close to her parents again, because she's left them behind when she leaves her village. And so she has this dream of having them come and live with her in this house that she's building. And I love that because I feel like so many of us have these dreams of buying a house or a car or a better life for our parents. And it's just such an incredible subplot that she has this almost finished, not quite paid for house, and the whole inspiration is to have her parents come live in it with her. And again, I'm not going to say anything about what happens with that, but it's such a storyline that resonated for me.
Well, you know, I think that in the same way that Lakshmi wants to somehow make it up to her parents for a life that they didn't get to lead, you know, they were poor. Her mother did not get to have this luxurious sort of existence that Lakshmi does now.
Right.
You know, her mother never got to build a house of her own. In that same way, you know, I think it's sort of like what I wanted to do for my mother is to return a gift to her that she gave me. So I wanted my mom to live through this fictional existence and be able to say, I lived that life that I always wanted to live.
Now, is your mom still living?
No. My mother died 2 to 3 years after I started writing the novel.
Oh.
But during that 2 to 3 years, that was the time when she and I were going back and forth to Jaipur a lot.
Oh.
And it was also the time that I was in my MFA program and I started writing this novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the perfect coming together of a lot of different forces that helped me write the novel at a time when I was immersed in Jaipur. I was immersed in time with my mother alone, and I got to ask her a lot about her childhood. And we visited her school. We talked to some of the students in that school today, the mistresses, the headmistresses, and so on. And so I think that in a strange sort of way, in my 50s, I came back to India and I gained a knowledge of my mother's life and also of my childhood. I gained an appreciation of the Indian culture that I hadn't had since I was a kid.
Right. It's funny because I read in the literature about the book that it took you 10 years to write the book. And then I read that you had an MFA, and I have that same 10-year book in my house that I wrote during my MFA. And I'm like, why is everybody acting like this is so unusual? She was working on her MFA. It takes a while.
It does. It does. People think that somehow when you write a book, you're just going to furiously write this book. And then the next thing you know, it's going to be published and off the printing presses. And, you know, it isn't like that. You can spend years thinking about your characters, working on them, thinking about how to go deeper into characters. And I was fortunate enough to have an agent in New York who would not let the book go out until I had done all of that hard work.
Now, wonderful.
She kept saying, no, we're not ready yet. You need to go deeper into these characters. And she said, I am not an editor, but you need to get an editor who can help you get there. So over time, I actually had 3 or 4 different people who helped me in that trajectory and would read the book and then give me a lot of comments. And I would go into a deep depression, Shayla. I would go into a deep depression because I would think, I thought I was finished. I can't believe I still have 10 more major changes I will have to make, or get rid of a character, or make this character deeper, or make this plot line more strong. And I have to thank my husband for helping me through those really dark times.
Yeah.
My husband is also a writer, so he completely understands what that's like.
Yeah.
And my husband said to me when we were probably married after about a year or two, he said, you know, honey, I think the reason you marry a writer is because you really want to be a writer. And I'd say, no, that's not. I really didn't think at that time I would ever write a novel or get into creative writing. But he saw something in me that I hadn't seen in myself.
Yeah.
He knew that I could write. And he knew that there were things I could mine from my childhood, from my experiences of India, that I probably wanted to write about. Uh-huh. He was absolutely right. So he would say to me, take a walk, Alka, step away from the computer, take a break. Don't go look at your manuscript for a while. Go do something else, because this is how you recharge your batteries and come back to your manuscript over and over again.
That's great. Well, you mentioned your agent, and you have earlier mentioned your editor. And I have a question, but you've sort of touched on it, but I wondered if you had any false starts in searching for an agent and a publisher. So do you want to talk a little bit from the beginning about how you got your agent?
I went about this whole process of selecting an MFA program very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that if I selected an MFA program that had instructors whose books I admired and whose books were somehow similar to mine, I would probably be able to study with them and ask them if they might refer me to their agent.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that in this world, this literary world, that if you don't know somebody, it's very hard to get your manuscript read.
Yeah.
By somebody at a big publishing house. They receive so many manuscripts that they are more likely to read one that came from another author in their house, or that came from another editor whom they know.
Mm-hmm.
So when I chose my MFA program, I went to it particularly because Anita Amirazvani, who is the author of Blood of Flowers, a 16th century Iranian novel, historical fiction novel. She was teaching at my MFA program, and I thought, she's the one I want to study with. I'm going there. And when I encountered her, I took a class from her and I said, would you please be my mentor? And we had one of our electives was that we got to choose a mentor. So she became mine, and I work with her very closely, and I found her to be a very generous, a very giving teacher, and she really helped me with the early stages of the book. And when I was about 4 to 5 years into it, I said, Anita, I'm going to send you a draft of where I am now. Could we please send this to your agent? At that time, she said, no, you're not quite ready. So she had me work on it a little bit more. And then finally, she said, okay, I will send it now to my agent. And her agent was Emma Sweeney in New York.
Wow.
She has since sold her agency to Folio Literary. But Emma loved the book right away, as I knew she would. If she liked Anita's book about Iran in the 16th, 17th century, I knew she would like my historical fiction about India. And she did. And so she told me right away, yes, I want to work with you. So my trajectory was a little different because I did a lot of research beforehand and made sure that I could be in that place at the right time to be in a situation where my manuscript could be read.
Wonderful. Okay.
One of the things I want to tell young people when they go into an MFA program, take a look at who your teachers are going to be. Don't select an MFA program because it has a good reputation. Select the MFA program where there are instructors whom you want to study with, mm-hmm. whom you think that you can learn from, make your mentor, and see if they are writing books that are similar to yours. Mm-hmm. That is one of the best pieces of advice that I can give to anybody who is considering joining an MFA program. Because, you know, they're expensive. And what you're paying for is really the opportunity to network with the instructors who are working writers, who can get you in front of working publications and publishing houses.
Okay. So when I interview people, I always like to ask what they're reading lately that they might recommend to listeners.
I love books that are set in other countries so I can learn about a different culture, a different society. I can learn the language of that culture a little bit. And so two books that I read most recently that I adored were Pachinko by mm-hmm. Min Jin Lee. And I thought that that was fabulous. It's set in Japan. It is all about the South Koreans who came over from South Korea to find jobs in Japan. And the book takes place over generations. So it's something you can really sink your teeth into and really learn a lot about these two cultures that intermingled. Mm-hmm. A second book that I really loved was All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr.
Yeah.
That takes you into World War II. And it is the story of a girl, a young girl in France and a young boy in Germany and how their lives eventually intersect during the war. And it's also, I think, a great way to learn how different people survived during the war and how situations that are beyond our control can sometimes coerce us into paths that we would not ordinarily have taken. I loved that feeling about that book.
Wonderful. Okay. I love that book too. That's great. I have not read Pachinko though, so that's a good extra one to put on my list. What about you? What are you working on next? Or have you started a project or do you not know yet?
I did. Last year, I thought I was going to start writing a novel about a real character in Indian history. She was an artist, and she was half Hungarian and half English. Uh-huh. I mean, half Indian. So I thought I was starting that book, but Malik, who is a character in The Henna Artist, mm-hmm. kept bugging me and saying, I want a story about me. I need to tell a story. So
he's such a lovely character. I love him.
You know, he came to me fully formed, Shayla. I saw Lakshmi traversing the city of Jaipur, and then I saw this little boy in my imagination, and he's following her. And eventually he approaches her, and she looks at him, and she realizes he doesn't want money. He wants to work. Mm-hmm. And so she hands him a tiffin, and he reaches for it. He holds it. He keeps looking at her. And she turns away and she starts walking away and he follows her. And that was the beginning of their working relationship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, he's so lovely. And so it was really easy for me to write him because he just came to my imagination as that kid whom you can't tell if he's 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, because he's like a lot of street kids in India.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Malik kept bugging me and I started writing his story.
Oh,
and that came so easily. I posted something on Instagram last fall and I said, oh, you know, I'm working on a sequel. Well, my agent found out. Emma called me and she said, what? You're working on a sequel? I said, well, I mean, you know, I just kind of, you know, I'm not really finished with it or anything. You know, it's not really formed. And she said, well, let's send some pages out to the editor and send a synopsis. And I said, well, I'm not sure where the story's going. And she said, well, you know, make it vague, but, you know, put a synopsis together. So I thought about it and I did that. And 3 days later, Emma called and she said, we have an offer on the sequel.
Wow.
I was like, wow. I have to tell you, Mira which is a subdivision of HarperCollins.
Right.
And my editor there, Kathy Sagan, have been so supportive of this novel. And then the Canadian division of HarperCollins has been so supportive of this novel. I've had so many people at that publishing house who have told me they loved the novel. They are totally behind the novel. This is even before Reese took it on. So I knew that we had a really solid base for getting the book into the hands of readers.
Sure.
And so Kathy said, absolutely, I'm buying that sequel.
Yeah.
And so I called my dad and I said, Dad, I have to come down and just hole up with you. And I have to write this novel. My dad goes, sure, come on down.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So he lives in LA. I flew down there. This is way before the pandemic. This is last December. And so I flew down there and I just started working on the novel, and I would work for 6 hours a day on my draft. And my dad would ply me with all of the subjis and rotis and samosas and piranhas that he had made, because he's a really good cook. And so I got to be, you know, in that Indian environment once again. It
nice.
Was in Los Angeles, but at least it was in that environment.
Yes.
And so I wrote the second draft. I mean, I wrote a draft of that sequel and I sent it off to Kathy, and now Kathy has it in her hands and she needs to give me some edits on it. But yes, so that is going to be coming out. We don't know when right now, but hopefully next year.
I'm sure she's excited too, because she's got so much invested in this cast of characters, and obviously really had a lot of faith in your book, The Henna Artist. So I'm sure she's excited. Let's see. Alka, I just have one last question for you. I wonder, I always like to finish up these interviews. A lot of my listeners are writers, so I like to finish up these interviews asking for advice. And in your case, I thought I would ask for advice about bringing a true story into fiction and fictionalize something that's inspired by maybe a kernel of truth.
Well, I always used to wonder when I was a reader, how much of this work was fiction and how much was it the writer's life? And now people are asking me that very same question. And I think that the answer comes to you organically as a writer. You start out with a germ of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start adding to it and characters start forming. And then pretty soon your characters are starting to do things that you hadn't expected. And you're writing all of that down. And as you go deeper and deeper into character, I think you're fictionalizing even more and more and more. And so your work does become a blend of the two, of reality and of fiction. And I'm not exactly sure when one takes precedence over the other, but it kind of does just happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved infusing all of the real things, like I told you about the food and then my father's lullaby that he always sang to me.
Yes.
I loved infusing the book with real things. Oh, and there was also the idea of a woman's gold is her retirement fund. And Lakshmi's mother was very upset at her father for having sold her gold for the Quit India movement. My father did the very similar thing to my mother's jewelry when the Indo-Chinese war was going on and the government asked for everybody's gold to finance the war. So I loved adding those little bits.
Yes.
In the novel that were real, but then I could take them much further. For example, Hari is a character I created because I needed a reason for Lakshmi to leave her marriage. And so
yeah.
Hari becomes this abusive character. Well, my father is not a physically abusive person at
right.
all. And my
right.
father is a college professor, so he doesn't resemble Hari in the least. But I needed that excuse. I needed a reason for Lakshmi to leave. So Hari was created. I needed a reason for Lakshmi to be able to sustain herself in Jaipur in ways that were almost clandestine in those days. And
mm-hmm.
so she is selling these herbal sachets that are contraceptives in addition to doing her henna work. And she actually makes more money doing the contraceptives. And so I thought, how is she going to sell those? Well, she needs a respectable character to help her sell those. And Samir was born.
Mm-hmm.
And how would she have ever met Samir? Oh, Samir would have been one of those people who visited courtesans. So then I invented the backstory where Lakshmi is first going to Agra into the houses of the courtesans. That is where she sells them her contraceptive sachets. And in turn, they are teaching her the art of henna. So then when she meets Samir in Agra, he says, why don't you come to Jaipur? I can introduce you to a whole lot of men who need to keep their mistresses childless. So you see, it's kind of a blending of the two. You start with something real, but then it evolves into these characters that are completely fictional because you're trying to create situations for your main character that are obstacles that she has to surmount,
right,
that she has to get beyond, and then eventually succeed. And how is that going to take place? I loved this world. Yeah. I loved creating these characters. I still miss them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why you can work with them.
Right. Right. And this is why the sequel came so much more easily, because I already know the characters. I know them so well. I know exactly what they're going to do in any given situation. So it's very easy to write that sequel. And then I even have a third book in my head right now that I will write after this is done.
Oh, that's so cool. I want to mention the name of the book again. It's The Henna Artist by Alka Joshi, published by Mira. Alka, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
I had such a great time. And thank you so much for every opportunity I get to talk to a reader or even a writer about this whole process. I am so grateful.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alka Joshi. You can learn more at thehennaartist.com. Alka Joshi generously offered us a Write the Book prompt for today's show. Think about a real person you know and reinvent their life. What if they had married someone different or lived in a different place or escaped a certain set of circumstances? What would have happened and who would they have been? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Google Play and all the podcast places, as well as writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, as always, please do talk about it with your friends and rate it in iTunes and like it on Facebook. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.